What I wanted to do, of course, was just kind of follow on for what we've been doing. We've been doing a protracted red letter study. I think this is something like the 30th week, but that's not important. That's not important. No matter what Frank says, it's not important. We're just going through the red letters and the words of Jesus. And for the last few Sundays, we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, especially because we hit Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And I got to tell you, this is probably my favorite portion of the Bible. You could take these three verses and you'd have the Bible right there. It is the distillation, the condensation, the concentrated message of Jesus all laid out in three chapters. It's an amazing, amazing three chapters of Scripture. It is beautifully constructed and beautifully laid out by the writer of Matthew, taking Jesus' sayings and putting them into an order that has an arrowhead on it. It just draws you right through. Jesus starts with the image of the finished product of someone who's living in kingdom. And then from there goes to state his mission, which is not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. He tells us straight out, this is what I'm here to do. Did not come to abolish the law, came to fulfill it. And then he takes the next two chapters and defines exactly what that means. What does it mean to fulfill the law without abolishing it? And the first thing he does throughout the balance of chapter 5, and we just finished chapter 5 last week, is to redefine law itself. To tell us that the law is not about following rules. The law is not about an absolute instrument that must be followed precisely in order to gain God's acceptance or approval, or to gain salvation. That the intent of the law is to preserve life and to bring into each life the awareness of God's presence and connection with each other. Kind of what we were talking about in terms of communion earlier today. And to fulfill that intent, to fulfill that purpose, sometimes you actually have to break the letter of the law. Because it's not the law that is absolute. It's the intent. It is the oneness and unity that kingdom is all about. That is the intent of God, the will of God. In fact, law in Hebrew doesn't even mean what we think of as law. Torah, the Torah of Moses, Moshe, the law of Moses is really the instruction or the guidance of Moses. And doesn't that put a different spin on it? You know? The law is designed like a mold or designed like a funnel to give us parameters within which to act and live our lives that will make us more and more aware of God's presence, to bring us more and more into community and connection with each other, to give us the opportunity to have the experience of God, the experience of God's love that will do its work in us. Because we can't trust something until we experience its trustworthiness. That goes for every human relationship. That goes for the very chair that you're sitting on. Only because chairs don't typically break underneath you, were you willing to just plop yourself down and give it your full weight. It's the same thing with everything else in life that we trust. We have to experience repeatedly the trustworthiness of someone or something before we do trust it. No different with God. Not because God ever changes, but because we're human. And that's the way we're wired, and that's the way we work. And so what the law does is funnel us into a mode of behavior that gives us this opportunity to experience God, experience his trustworthiness over and over and over again until we actually do trust him. And once we do, then we can drop the defensiveness. We can drop our shields. We can drop the barriers that we put between us and someone else, including the use of the law to protect ourselves. We can leave this defensive position and move into another position that Jesus calls kingdom. And so basically, what you find is that there are two ways to live life. You can live it in fear, or you can live it in love. When I say that to people, sometimes they say, well, I'm not afraid. You know, and we don't typically experience that fear as afraidness, as terror. It's not that kind of fear. And yet, I can tell you this, most people in the world live their lives from a fear base, not from a love base. In fact, you probably If you've known anyone in your life that lives life from a love base, they stand out head and shoulders above the rest because of the differences in that ripple effect that we were talking about earlier, in the way that they impacted your life. You know them. They stand out. They're somehow different. And it's sad that they are. But here's the thing. If I tell you that most people in the world are living in a fear base, then that means most of us in this room are living in a fear base. So how do we know what we're doing? How do we know how we're living? How can we self-assess to find out where we are on this continuum? Because, you know, it's not binary. It's not on or off. It's not all fear or all love. You know, there's probably nobody on the planet who is all completely, purely one thing. We're all a mixed bag. But we're somewhere on that continuum. And what we're striving for is not purely to live in the love base, because that's probably impossible, but we want to be characterized by living in love. 51%. Progress, not perfection. Any way that you choose to look at it. We want to be more often than not coming from this base of love. How do we know if we are or not? Check your stress level. Think about it. Are you a person who gets angry easily? Do the littlest things set you off? Someone cuts you off on the freeway and you're off to the races. You know, you're just trying to control the urge to speed up and come parallel to that car so that you can give them a piece of your mind. You know, are the littlest things within your household setting you off? Do you find yourself constantly trying to tamp down that rising anger in you? Are you defensive? Do you worry a lot about things in life? And does that worry spill over into envy? Worried about what someone else has that you want? Or does it spill over into jealousy? Worried about losing something that you have? Is there a lot of stress and anxiety? Do you find yourself having trouble sleeping at night? Do you have to take pills to sleep at night? Then do you have to take pills to get up in the morning? The sum total of the negative emotions that we go through, including depression, including stress and anxiety, are the measure of fear in our life. Why is that? Because when you think about it, if you live in a fear base, what you are afraid of is not getting your needs met. Living in a fear base assumes that life starts from the point of need, starts from the point of want, starts from the point of lack, and that we are on that hamster wheel constantly trying to get the things that we need, trying to gain the approval that we think that we don't have, trying to gain salvation that we think is elusive and based in some sort of legal system or ethical or moral code that we have to follow. To live in fear is to assume that the glass is half empty and somehow we've got to fill it in order to fill in the blank, be happy, be fulfilled, you know, lead the life that we want to lead, have the assurance of salvation on the other side. To live in a love-based is to assume that we start from the place of abundance and not need. How in the world do we do that? Because luck. There's a thing called entropy here, right? Everything goes from order to disorder. There is no free lunch. We always have to push the rock up the hill, and as soon as we stop, it rolls back down again. If we don't work, we don't eat, and it just seems like the bills are constantly coming, and there just isn't enough funds and enough money. How in the world can I assume that I come from a place of abundance? But this is exactly the message that Jesus is trying to give us. He's trying to say, you have an inheritance. You have a father. You have a place at the table, an acceptance, a love that you cannot lose. Everything that the Father has is already yours and always has been. And there's nothing you can do to change that fact. No matter how low you think you've sunk, no matter how many things you think you've done wrong against that set of rules again, nothing can change the fact of the Father's love. Nothing can change the fact that you have everything that you need to fulfill your purpose as a human being, regardless of the state of your credit score or your bank account. Because our purpose as a human being has nothing to do with that, and isn't that good news? Here's the point. Jesus does everything that he can for his entire ministry, and everything here in the Sermon on the Mount is based on this notion of kingdom, the foundation of which is that we already have everything that we need, that we are starting from a place of abundance. That's the fundamental difference. The people in your life that stand head and shoulders above the rest, the ones that have impacted you so positively, the ones that you admire and look up to and know they would be there for you no matter what, are the ones who know that they have something that they cannot lose. Some sort of blessed assurance has crept into their heart at some level. Maybe it's just over that 51% line. It doesn't matter. In that moment, they were equal to the moment and able to be fully present to you, to drop those defensive shields and to allow you in. And you know the difference. This is why Jesus was so magnetic to the people that he was teaching. He was the completely integrated and fulfilled man. He was the one completely open and transparent. He was the one completely free to accept, to draw in, to sit at table with. He was free to do that because he knew his Father and he knew the news was good. And that's what he was trying to get across to all of us. That's the fundamental shift. But it's hard to make because all of the evidence of our lives runs counter to that. So it's difficult for us to just out of whole cloth pull out this notion that suddenly we're coming to this life from a position of abundance. But if we can experience those moments with our God, we will know that we know in a deep way, beyond words that we can express, the true fact of that relationship and the way that it works. That's the key. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to us. And so in chapter 5, he redefines the law in such a way to try to get this notion of our connection with God from a legal standpoint to a relational standpoint. If we can finally put a stake in the heart of that notion that the law saves, that following these rules makes a difference in terms of our approval of the love that we get from God, and move it over to this relationship. If we can do that, if that's a starting point, and so everything that he did in that fifth chapter was along those lines. You think you're safe just because you sit under the letter of the law, but I'm going to tell you something different. It's about the innermost place of your heart. And if you can connect at that level, everything changes. It's not that you abolish the law. It's not that you're free to break the law with impunity, but you will be living the law in a new way, beyond rules, beyond obedience, whole different relationship. Now in chapter 6, he's going to make a transition. Instead of redefining the law, he is going to redefine righteousness. Because to the Jews, righteousness was a huge thing. Righteousness was the proof of your pedigree, the proof of your relationship with God. And they measured righteousness in three different ways. They measured it with prayer, they measured it with almsgiving, and they measured it with fasting. These were the three outward signs to the rabbis, to the Pharisees, who were the main religious leaders of Jesus' time, as to whether a person was righteous or not. Right? Did they give to the poor? Did they give alms? Did they pray? And did they fast? Jesus is going to take each one of these in succession, and he's going to redefine them too, and try to get it down to a place where the people can understand what the nature of this thing is. Because in a sense, what the Pharisees had done to righteousness and their test of righteousness was exactly the same thing that they had done to the law. They had turned it into a litmus test. They had turned it into this bar that you had to cross before you could be accepted or approved. And they've done the same thing with these three areas of righteousness. And beyond that, they use them in public ways to self-aggrandize, to show everyone how righteous they were. When they gave alms, they made sure everybody knew how much they were giving. When they prayed, they would stand on the street corners or in the busiest place of the market at the three fixed time of prayer that the Jews observed so that everybody could see how much they prayed and how well they did. And when they fasted, they would put on gloomy faces and sometimes even rub ash into their cheeks so they would look so gray and sallow, you know. Everybody would know that they were suffering for their righteousness. Jesus is going to take this and turn it around in another way as well. Let's take a look what he says here right at the beginning of chapter 6. Matthew 6, 1 to 4. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Okay, now at face value, just reading the English translation, it seems pretty straightforward, right? We can understand what he's saying. But let's dig a little deeper. Let's go into the Hebrew context and see what is there that can give us better insight into where Jesus is trying to take us. Phrase by phrase, this idea of practicing your righteousness, literally the translation would be doing righteousness. And the word for righteousness there is tzedakah. I didn't say that very well. Tzedakah. Kind of like Neil, tzedakah. 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 Doing tzedakah, doing righteousness, was an idiomatic phrase in Hebrew. You know, that's a phrase that you can't understand just by knowing the definitions of the words. It's a phrase that was agreed upon, a meaning that was agreed upon by the people. And doing righteousness, this phrase meant doing charitable deeds, giving charitable gifts, doing acts of mercy. And so literally, even though tzedakah is righteousness, doing righteousness in this sense was acts of mercy, giving to the poor. We call it giving alms. And so this idea here of practicing your righteousness before men, don't give your gifts to the poor. Don't do your acts of mercy before men to be noticed by them, to be noticed by others. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. We'll hit this idea of reward in a second. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do. And so we can think of that just sort of in a metaphorical sense. You know, don't make a big show, don't blow your horn, don't do this, do that. But it had a literal meaning as well, and it was another one of those Hebraic phrases. Because in the temple, in the court of women, the court of the women, there was a separate court for the women. They had to stay behind a latticed barrier. And in that court of women, there were 13 boxes around the entrances. And these boxes stood on pedestals, and they were narrow at the top, and they widened down at the base. So they looked like a trumpet horn that was inverted. And you would put money at the top, and then this money was later distributed to widows and orphans and people who needed it. Well, if you really wanted to let people know, you'd take a big wad of coins and dump them all down at the same time, and they make a big sound and a big splash. And, of course, everybody turned to see who it was who put that big amount of money in. That was called sounding the trumpet. So we can take it metaphorically and get the sense of it, but literally this is what was happening. If you wanted to make a big splash, if you wanted to let people know you were really righteousness and doing your good deeds, you dumped all that money down in such a way that they couldn't help but hear. Do not sound the trumpet. So that they may be honored by men, truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And again, we can take that metaphorically, but literally what the Hebrews would often do is to assign intent and action to a body part, kind of an anthropomorphism, you know, taking just the body part as if it were the entire person. It's kind of like if your eye leads you into sin, gouge it out. If your hand leads you to stumble, if your foot does, it's the same sort of idea. And so what the right hand or left hand is doing, as if they were two different people in your body, you know, don't let each one know what the other one is doing. Conversely, it can also mean your nearest and dearest friend, the one that sits right next to you all the time. Do your acts of mercy in such a way that they can't even see what the other hand is doing. The whole idea is keep it in this secret place. And even the sense of secret. Did you know that in the temple there's a chamber of secrets? And it has nothing to do with Harry Potter, believe me. There were two chambers inside the sanctuary of the temple. One was a chamber of secrets and the other was a chamber of vessels. There were 93 different vessels, sacred vessels, that were used in the execution of all the temple affairs and temple events, you know, from bowls and dishes and cups and menorah and all different sorts of vessels that were made out of precious metals. And they were stored in the temple of vessels in one section of it. The other section of the temple of vessels were where you could accept donations. So people could come and bring their donations of different types of vessels and urns and cups and whatnot. And then at different times during the year, the temple authorities would inspect them and see which ones were good enough to use in the temple, and others were sold off, and the money was used to support the temple. And so that was a chamber of vessels. In the chamber of secrets, it was an anonymous fund. It was a place where you could, in complete secrecy, bring any gifts that you wanted to give to the poor, drop them in there. They went to just a lumped fund, and that was anonymously distributed to those who needed it. Very different if you gave your money in the chamber of secrets than if you gave it into one of the trumpets, one of the collection boxes in the court of the women. And so Jesus could be alluding to this idea. In secret, they understood this, you know, the chamber of secrets and what that all meant. And so he's trying to get something across to them about how we can do this thing, how we can move through these areas of righteousness. And in every one of these examples, he's coming back to this idea of reward. What is this reward that he's talking about here? Now, when we think of a reward, obviously we think of, you know, we do something good and we get paid. We get a reward. It's just like wages. We do a day's labor and we get a day's wages. You know, there's an if-then kind of causality. We do this and we get this reward. And we do this now and we can get the reward later. Sometimes it's a lot later. When a Christian reads this idea of reward, especially in this context, in this passage, what is the immediate understanding that we're going to have? That our reward is in heaven. And by that we mean the heaven of the next life. One commentator was writing that the reward Jesus is talking about is delivered at the Bema seat. And I don't know if any of you know what that means, but it's the judgment seat of Christ. It's the seat where people are separated in different categories. And there's this image of this judgment seat, and that's the place where this reward is going to be passed out. But I want you to keep in mind something. This entire sermon is delivered in the context of kingdom. And we have defined kingdom over and over again, but just to keep it in mind, kingdom is not a place, it's not a territory. And it's not separated in time from this moment right here and right now. The kingdom Jesus is talking about is the quality of life that is available and possible right here, right now. When we are connected with our Father Spirit, when we are connected with each other, that moment of transparency, living that life with that kind of humility, that kind of perseverance is kingdom. Literally, we are kingdom when we are living our lives that way. So we have to understand Jesus' sense of reward within that context of the nowness, the here-ness of kingdom. It's not out there someplace. God never withholds anything. Can we ever understand that fully? Can we ever get that fully? It is so ingrained in us that if we don't do well, then God isn't going to reward us. If we do the wrong thing, God is going to punish us, withhold blessings. Jesus is here saying, my Father in heaven doesn't operate that way. My Father in heaven is always pouring out. He is always blessing. He can't do anything else because that's who he is. So what is this reward? Jesus is trying to say, when you allow yourself to be so connected to the other person that your act of mercy, your gifts just flow out automatically on the need that you perceive in that moment, that point of connection, that oneness that you experience with that person, with the Spirit of your God encompassing and infusing everything in that moment, that is your reward. It's simultaneous. It's all one and the same thing. The act itself, the connection itself, is the reward. It's not separated in time. We will never experience that until we actually do the thing that Jesus is talking about. Not because it's a good deed, not because the law says to, not because we're supposed to tithe 10%. You know, as soon as you attach a number to it, as soon as you attach a percentage to it, you have killed all of the intent of what giving is supposed to be. Now it's a tax. As soon as it's 10%, it's a tax. And as soon as it's 10%, we're trying to figure, is that gross or is that net? You know, what do I need to do? Looking for loopholes. We go into a completely different place in our minds. We go into a completely different place in our spirits. It's not about attaching figures to it. It's about being present in the moment, seeing a need, and just flowing outward. That is the reward Jesus is talking about. That sense of connection, that sense of meeting of spirit. Because we were talking last week about Simon, the Pharisee, and the sinful woman. Remember? Jesus is invited to the home of a Pharisee. They're at table. The Pharisee is there to try to grill Jesus and find out what he's all about. A woman comes in, a known sinner, and is crying on his feet and anointing his feet. And, of course, everybody's horrified because she's a sinner and she just made Jesus unclean. And if he was a prophet, he would have known that, would have shooed her away. And we talked about what was the difference. Jesus said, she who was forgiven much loves much, and he who is forgiven little loves little. And we said, well, that's not always true. Some people dodge bullets of big things all the time and don't have the least sense of loving much or gratitude. But where Jesus is going is, Simon felt entitled under the law. He had done everything right. He was entitled to his position. He was entitled to his approval and acceptance. Therefore, he had no gratitude. Therefore, he was in a position to judge her, judge others, separate himself further from those who didn't live up to his expectations. And yet the woman was just there, realizing she was getting a gift she could never give herself in pure gratitude. It's the same thing that's going on here. If we for an instant think that we have earned our position with God, we won't be grateful for our position with God. In fact, we're going to be angry when we feel we didn't get what we deserved, what we were entitled to. And those resentments build into the absolute antithesis of kingdom in our lives. Reward cannot mean entitlement to Jesus, because everything about Jesus is about gratitude, about starting from a place of abundance and not from a place of need or lack. And of course, to a Jew, the reward would never be something in heaven, because they're focused on this life here and now, always. So this idea of reward is part of this notion that Jesus is trying to get across to us. It's here now. So given all of that, how are we supposed to understand giving? How are we supposed to understand what we're supposed to do here? Paul tells us to give hilariously, give cheerfully. You know, we're supposed to give. And we have been pounded over and again mercilessly by other churches. We try not to do that here to you here. But I know so many churches and places that I've been, that you've been, that message of tithing, that message of 10%, that message of giving, 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 has been so pounded into us that we don't know what to make of it anymore. We feel extorted at times. At least I have. I'll speak for myself. I've felt extorted before by the church, this message of giving constantly. And yet I know that I'm supposed to do it. How am I supposed to react to that? What is the correct mix here? What is giving really supposed to be? So maybe go back to intent again, the way Jesus always does. What's the intent of giving a gift? Now, I've heard so many times people say, you can't outgive God. Have you heard that one before? Can't outgive God. Now, what is meant by that? When someone says, you need to give because you can't outgive God. Well, the idea is that if you give to this person or you give to this church, that God is going to return in kind probably more. I've heard it often said that any tithe that you give will be returned to you 100-fold. Well, that's not a gift. That's an investment. It's not even a tax. It's an investment. If the intent of our giving is only to get back, then that has nothing to do with what Jesus is talking about. That's simply an investment. It's a way, another way of getting what we think we want and what we think we need. Leonard Sweet, I don't know if you've heard of him before. Really interesting. He's a Methodist pastor and a prolific writer and a real forward thinker. You know, gets himself in trouble every now and again. But he had a paper that was entitled, Freely You Have Received, Now Freely Give. And he wrote about tithing. He wrote about a lot of these areas. And you know, one of the points that he makes is that in the Old Testament law, if you added up all the tithes that the ancient people were supposed to tithe, it wasn't 10%. It was almost 24%. And it was just like a tax. It wasn't a request. You know, you needed to give that money. because that's what supported the temple and the Levites and so on and so forth. And then, of course, there were civil taxes upon that, on top of that. So the tax rate was somewhere between 40 and 50% if you added the tithe and the tax to it and all these sorts of things. We have fixated on this 10% as if it means something, but it really doesn't. It's an arbitrary number that we have pulled. And as soon as we attach that number to it, it changes everything anyway. Leonard's larger point is that we are always fixated on giving and not on receiving. And when you think about it, what's God's position to us in our lives? He's the giver and we're the receiver. But we're uncomfortable with being a receiver because that makes us vulnerable. That makes us imperfect. That makes us, puts us in a position of out of controlness. We want to be the giver because then we can exert some control. We want God's position, not our position, is what he's saying. In other words, we sort of have a God complex when it comes to giving. We always want to be in that position, in the superior position. He says, we have to learn how to receive. He says, the best parts about Leonard Sweet is not what he's given, but what he has received from God. And I think he's really got something there. And then he quotes the membership agreement of Church on the Savior in Washington, D.C. And I had the pleasure of attending that church a few times when I was in D.C. And their whole idea is that we are the ower and God is the owner. In other words, God owns everything. We're merely caretakers or stewards of a small portion of it for a short period of time. And what we do with that portion has everything to do with the nature of our character, has everything to do with the nature of this transformation we're talking about. And so changing the whole paradigm of this relationship to giving and receiving and to God and to each other starts to help us to drill down into exactly what Jesus is driving at here. And I wanted to read you this story because this one story still has the ability to shock us a little bit that Jesus tells, because it's one that has not been really interpreted much that I've seen. And it just seems to fly in the face of everything that we think about morally or ethically or under the law. But Jesus is giving us a really important principle here. At Luke 16:1, now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and he said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill, and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. What is Jesus talking about? Doesn't this seem completely unethical, immoral, unlawful? Why would Jesus hold this type of behavior up as a model for his followers in this particular parable? What's he driving at here? The key is in this notion of the wealth of unrighteousness, translated elsewhere as unrighteous mammon. The mammon that we normally understand as money is really a larger concept than that in Hebrew. Mammona was the Canaanite god of avarice and greed and wealth. And so mammon came to be associated with anything that we value highly in our life, anything that we pile up in our life that comes to define us, who we are, what we cling to, what we rely on. That's our mammon. It didn't have to just be physical wealth. It could be looks or talent or anything that we get our security from. That's the mammon. So now there's this notion of unrighteous mammon. And immediately what we think of is mammon, wealth, money that was unrighteously obtained. Right? But what they're driving at, it's not wealth that was unrighteously obtained. It was wealth that was unrighteously retained. Because there is this sense in the Hebrew culture that God was the provider, that he was the one who flowed all of the abundance through his people. And just like sitting on the bank of the river and taking a drink, you know, you don't have to dam up the entire river to take a drink out of the river that you need this day. You just take a drink and you let the rest of the river flow. It was the same thing with the idea of your income stream, with the idea of your wealth. It was flowing through your household like a river. You took what you needed at that moment. You took a drink. But you were supposed to let the rest flow through to the people who needed it, not dam it all up. And see, this is what people do from time immemorial. It's what we do now. We take our money, we hold on to it tightly, we invest it, we put it into all these instruments. You know, we're constantly managing our money and looking at it and watching it grow or fall, and our moods and our life seems to revolve around the zeros in our bank account, looking at that place. But God's spirit is called Ruha in Aramaic. Ruha means wind and breath and spirit all at the same time. And wherever you see mention of God's spirit in the New Testament or in the Old Testament, it's always in motion, because wind has to be in motion or it's not wind. It's just air. And your breath is always in motion or you're not alive. You're dead. The idea of tying God's spirit to breath and wind was purposely done to try to get the idea across of constant motion, of something always blowing through our lives. If we are in concert, if we are in communion with God's Spirit, then we must be in motion too. And if we're not in motion, if our resources, if those things that are most dear to us are not also in motion, then they are not in concert with God's Spirit. And we are not living in kingdom. Jesus is saying, make use of the unrighteous mammon by letting it flow to the people who need it. Therefore, you can make friends with them, so when you need it, their wealth will flow to you. That's the way it's supposed to work. If everybody let their unrighteous mammon flow, everybody, there would be enough for everyone. Scientists have said there is enough food on this planet to feed every last man, woman, and child. It's the politics that keep the food from the people who need it. That's it. The abundance is there. The will is not. Or said better, the abundance is there, but the fear is too great to allow it to flow. And we come back to that notion of fear. Why do you dam up your flow? Why do you put a dam on the river? Why do you put a dam on your bank accounts? Why are you too afraid to let your resources flow? Because you don't know if you're going to get it back. You don't know if there's something that you can't lose. You don't know if you can risk that much. Jesus is telling us, yes, you can. We had a vacation last week. Took 5 days off. It was over like that, I tell you. One of the things that we did was we went to what used to be called the Wild Animal Park, and now I guess it's a safari park. It was amazing. If you haven't been there in a while, you got to go again. It's like a completely different park. But one of the things that they have added is a balloon ride. And so they've got this huge helium balloon, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of feet across, and they send it up on a cable 400 feet, and it's got this donut-shaped gondola underneath it. So you have a track that you can kind of walk around the circumference of, and you can look down the middle or you can look down the sides. And I just had to go up, and Marion's never been on a balloon before, so she wanted to go up. I've done a hot balloon ride before, but Marion hadn't, so we went up in this thing, and it takes you up 400 feet, and you can see just everything, and it was just so nice up there. It was 100 degrees and humid on the ground. I mean, it was really hot. Up there was this breeze coming and blowing, and it was beautiful up there. But I was trying to explain to Marion the difference between this experience on this particular balloon and an actual hot balloon ride. And the difference, of course, is you're tethered. We're sitting on this string. And so the wind's blowing in our face. The thing that shocked me the most about going up in a hot air balloon was I thought there would be a wind blowing in my face. And when I got up there, everything was as still as the air in this room right now. Maybe even more still because the air conditioner is blowing completely, completely still. And I had to stop and think, what in the world? Well, duh, the wind is blowing the balloon. You're going at the same speed and the same direction as the wind, so you don't feel the wind. This is the analogy. This is the metaphor that helps me to understand this motion of the Spirit in my life and my motion with it. If I can move with the Spirit, if I can let the Spirit's motion through my life blow me, then I don't feel the gale in my face. It's as if we just are all moving together, because we are, and everything is still, everything is connected, everything is ordered. But we have to let things flow. So I'm telling you to empty all your bank accounts and empty your CDs and your money markets. And no, of course not. Absolutely not. We need to be responsible. It means that, yes, we do need to plan for the future. And yes, we do need to plan for our kids' educations and everything else we do. Don't, you know, stop your life insurance policies. None of that matters. It's about the state of your heart. Are you the kind of person, when you are in the moment and presented with need, will you let it flow? Can you stop all of the rationalizations and all of the interior talk that talks you out of, well, maybe they really weren't going to use it for what I think they're going to use it for, maybe this, maybe that. We go through this whole thing, and sometimes we need to be discerning. I understand that. But you need to know and be ruthlessly honest with yourself. Is that an excuse? Is that a rationalization? Or is that true discernment? And are you the kind of person who can just see need, be connected to it, and let your resources flow? Even if it's just a smile in the grocery aisle, will you let that flow? Will you be that person who can move with the prompting of the Spirit and use the unrighteous mammon, not retain it, but just let it go? This is giving that Jesus would understand as being its own reward, as allowing us those moments of connection, of understanding what it means to be in the position of complete identification and connection with another person, to see them as an extension of ourselves, which is why our resources can flow, to let the fear drop for just a second, stop worrying, give what you can in whatever way that you can, whether it's in the moment or whether it's in another moment that seems offline, and will give to someone later on, it doesn't really matter. In your moment, can you be that person who lets go of the fear and moves from that place of fear, that place of seeming lack and want and need and the need to be defensive and to hold on, to someone who is free enough to let it go? This is the shift that Jesus is working on us. If we can understand what he's talking about just enough to overcome the risk just enough to have an experience of what that feels like, we're going to want another and another one after that. And you string enough of those moments along and your life takes on a new direction, a direction that Jesus calls kingdom. And the giving becomes the true nature of transformation and not just another rule to follow. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much. Our only reaction can be gratitude sometimes for everything that you do for us. Thank you for loving us the way that you do. Thank you for giving in exactly this way to us, which is the only model that we'll ever have. You give so freely because you are free. And you know that if we can be swept up in that movement, that we will become free as well. So help us to let go of whatever we need to let go of, Lord, so that we can be more in tune, more freely moving with your Spirit and letting everything flow through us. We love you only because you first loved us. Thank you for this day. Thank you for Kate and her willingness to be baptized today. And we look forward to that moment as well. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.